You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Greetings from soggy Washington, D.C., Alexandria, actually, luckily, I'm on the fourth floor right now, but Alexandria is prone to flooding, so...
Now, I'm not following hurricane coverage too closely, but are you in the are you in the window where the hurricane's supposed to hit?
No. Thank goodness this is going to hit North Carolina, South Carolina, North Carolina mainly, but we're going to get remnants of the rainfall, and there could be. We've gotten so much rain; it's such a weird weather year. Normally, September and October are glorious, glorious months in your nation's capital. You may recall on 9/11 in 2001, it was an utterly beautiful day. That's part of what made it kind of so eerie. And every year when I get that sensation of the beginning of autumn and how the weather, how beautiful the sun, it gives me that feeling. And this year is totally different. Mm. We've had so much rain. And the danger here, luckily we're not going to be hit by the storm directly, but the danger here is that the ground is so saturated that you could have any wind could uproot trees and there could be power outages, which would not be good, but it's much, you know, we are much, much better off than people to our south.
Now, we didn't discuss this in our little pregame before recording.
Our extensive pre-interview,
right,
where our producers meticulously go over the show notes. Yeah. Well,
what do you make of Trump's hurricane tweeting? Isn't it strange that he is constantly running down Puerto Rico, bragging about his response everywhere? I'm always struck by Republican handlings of hurricanes, quite frankly. I mean, obviously, there's you know, Bush and Katrina, most famously.
But Jeb Bush being a positive example, as I recall, that Jeb Bush in Florida really rose to the occasion during natural disasters, which is part of the reason why it's so weird what happened with Katrina.
Well, before that, when George H.W. Bush was president, he was criticized for his Hurricane Andrew response in the 92 campaign. I've always remembered that in Bill Clinton's autobiography, he has a section where he said, I made a mental note that I'm not going to get elected because of a hurricane response, but I sure as heck could lose an election if I don't have a good hurricane response. So I'm going to make darn sure I appoint a professional to head FEMA. You know, FEMA was created by Jimmy Carter. Tail end of his presidency, so didn't get much attention around it. Reagan and Bush didn't take the agency very seriously. It tended to be sort of a patronage position, but only Bush got really, you know, singed by it. Clinton is the first person to appoint a real pro, emergency management pro, in James Lee Witt. And I just would have thought after that, regardless of parties, it's not inherently ideological, you would say, okay, no matter what you think about the role of government,
yeah,
you're going to get burned.
I think Trump would be. You could argue that Trump would be the kind of guy who would take it very seriously. And look, I mean, for all I know, I'm sure that there are serious people working in the Trump administration doing very hard work. I'm confident that that's true. But the rhetoric of Trump, and obviously the mishandling in Puerto Rico, but the rhetoric of Trump is specifically what you're talking about. I mean, yesterday he did an interview where he was like something to the effect of the storm is very bad and very wet,
right?
Something like that. It's like, come on, you know.
But why don't Republicans just say, you know, whether it's, you know, Bush or Trump? Yeah. Let's just hire a pro so I don't have to think about it.
That's what I was going to say about Trump is, of all the people, you could imagine Trump being the guy who actually is not philosophically opposed to big government.
Right.
And sees himself as bringing in the best people, you know, like there is an argument that Trump should be the best Republican for these kind of patronage things where he can, you know, swoop in and take credit. And believe me, you know,
but
I don't care about the budget. Believe me, you know, we're going to take care of you. It's a populist thing, right?
Well, I think he's populist in the Jacksonian sense. This is old school spoil system. You win and you hand out the jobs to your friends. And there hasn't been any sense with Trump that merit is a significant criteria in any of these jobs.
Look, I'm all for patronage. We can save that for naming post offices. When it comes to FEMA,
right? Of all the jobs, like you could be like the biggest libertarian, but like that one job, you shouldn't say, "Let's have a government pro on this job."
Yes. No, I agree. And there is a weird thing where, I mean, let's remove this from the very serious part, which has to do with emergency management and natural disasters and crises. But I've always believed that, you know, back in my old days, before I got into journalism, I worked on a race for a state senator and then his reelect, I did some volunteering for. And this is just a state senator, and it was a machine. I mean, if you were in the paper, if you were having a bar mitzvah or your Boy Scout troop was doing something, you would get a letter from the state senator congratulating you. If you were celebrating your 50th anniversary, you would get a letter from him. He would go to your graduation or your what? I mean, like. And this is a guy who was very conservative. I don't see any – I think that like part of the job is constituent service and helping people if they can't get their check from the veteran, you know, from the VA. They're having a hard time getting the check. Like your job is to help them take care of that even if you're a small government conservative. I got the sense during the Tea Party era that Republicans and conservatives felt like that was somehow dirty, that like helping your constituents was somehow not – part of the small government conservative philosophy. And one of the good things I think maybe about the new Trump era is that, you know, we can get past that a little bit.
Now, I was listening to CNN this morning and I heard Jeffrey Toobin say on a panel, you know, flat out, you know, the reason why Trump is so obnoxious to Puerto Rico vis-a-vis relative to how he treats any other state that's hurt by a natural disaster, is that they're not white. And the anchor of the panel seemed, you know, taken aback that Toobin just said that, you know, flat out and didn't immediately, you know, nod their heads and concur.
Yeah.
And you know,
I mean, I think that's a speculation. It's not an absurd speculation, but I think you could also argue it's not part of the mainland, that he doesn't need their votes. There are other less malicious explanations, or less nefarious explanations for his behavior.
Well,
that's one. I mean,
well,
I'm not saying that
those explanations are still pretty nefarious.
But I'm not saying. I said less nefarious, not noble. They're certainly not noble. I think that racism is like, we don't know that for a fact. It's plausible, but that's like the most nefarious theory.
But and the two,
it might just be harder in. I hate to interrupt you again, but it may just be harder to do Puerto Rico than Texas also. Okay.
Well, that's sort of his argument. Oh, this is so far away. You can't expect us to do as good a job there, but that's not...
It's not that far away.
It's part of America. It's part of your job to deal with any natural disaster on American territory is your job. So if it is physically harder, then you figure out ahead of time how to deal with that fact. It's your job. But to the point that they're not voters or even that Puerto Ricans on the mainland who know people on Puerto Rico are not his voters, whether it's not literally racism. The fact remains that his voting base is predominantly white, and the fact that he treats his voters more kindly than other people's voters, you know, whether it's not literally racism and that I think that white people are genetically superior to other people, you can't remove race from that equation because he has cultivated a base of support that is almost solely white.
Yeah. No, I think that's an interesting point. And I mean, I think it speaks to the, you know, unconscious systemic racism, right? So it's not, you may not consciously be thinking, I don't care about them because they're not my people. But if you just never happen to think of them, or if for whatever reason you care a little bit less about deploying resources to them, it doesn't really matter to the people in Puerto Rico why you are not putting them front and center. It just is what it is.
But this is even more than neglect, because he's actively using them as a political foil. Join me in being mad at the Puerto Rican political leadership for not being grateful for all I've done for them.
Yeah.
I
haven't delved into the specifics. I would not be surprised to learn that there is some incompetence in local government as well. You know, George W. Bush during Katrina basically decided, I'm not going to point fingers at Nagin and, you know, local officials. Like, I am going to take the hit. I'm the leader. And, like, that may be
other people pointed fingers at Nagin. Maybe not Bush,
yeah,
but
I think that I think Bush absorbed almost all of the blame. And, you know, that may be like the more honorable thing to do, you know, with a buck stops here kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But politically speaking, Republicans may have been better off if Donald Trump had been there pointing the finger at the governor and the mayor, you know?
Although I think they'll ultimately be better off just having a good FEMA operation.
That would be nice, wouldn't it?
Well, so let me say a little bit into Trump's approval numbers, which they've never been good. No one can argue that
even on election day, right, when he won the election, right, his approval numbers were really bad.
Right. I mean, he has never been at 50 or above in any of the polling averages that I've seen. I know he's never been at 50 in the Gallup tracking poll. I think maybe he's touched 50 in like Rasmussen a few times.
It's such an interesting thing, right? And look, I know, you know, Bill Clinton won twice without winning the majority of the vote. We've had plenty of presidents who became president, even if they, you know, even if they have a plurality, they don't have above 50% of the popular vote. But having said that, it is interesting to think that a solid majority of Americans can disapprove of you and you still win.
Right.
And could be reelected.
Right. Like, so that's why,
well within the realm of possibility that, right, Donald Trump could do this again.
Yeah. So that's why when Trump, you know, reaches 45, everyone's like, wow, 45. That's really good. Because it's like when your 4 year old draws a drawing. Nice job, little Jimmy.
I don't mean to like dwell on this, but I think it's worth pausing to consider the fact that a solid majority of Americans can disapprove of you and you can still be elected president. That is, am I the only one who I'm still like when I think when we were sort of assessing can Donald Trump win? And I remember vividly, Bill, you may remember, I toward the end of election day, I was starting to think Trump has a shot. And I said, I think Hillary's going to win. But the reason is, I think she's going to have a better ground game on election. You know, I had some reasons, right? But I was getting cold feet toward the end for Hillary. But one of the reasons I thought was, how do you win when 55 or 60% of Americans disapprove of you?
Right. Well,
how do they? But people can vote for you even if they disapprove for you.
Right. I mean, part of the reason was disapproving the other person more. But part of it is also that the whole system is not, it's not a literally small d democratic system.
Yes.
It is not based on popular vote. It's based on electoral college. And Trump had the vote in the right places. That's why it's a pet peeve of mine when I hear Trump defenders, you know, or even we can talk about Brett Kavanaugh a little bit later, you know, saying, well, you know, the voters elected Trump because X, Y, and Z. No, the voters actually did not elect Trump. I mean, and I'm not saying that to delegitimize it, but just as a matter of literal fact, he was elected by the electoral college.
I think that's pedantic, but it's
relevant because the system is created to not be dependent on tyranny of the majority. It's meant to have diffusely spread out power, so all factions of the country have a say. And so just because you can become president not through a literal popular majority, those who didn't vote for that person get their say, you know, through senators or House members or the judicial branch or what have you. So we should be recognizing his presidency as one that is a minority presidency, and not to delegitimize, but to understand the nature of government that we have.
Should we have added that caveat every time Bill Clinton's people said, hey, look.
I heard it plenty at the time. I mean, the day of the election, Bob Dole said, I'm going to represent the 57% of the country that didn't vote for Bill Clinton. So it's not wrong for him to try to do that.
Yeah, okay. I'm just saying, as a political commentator who has to be pithy, I don't like the guy who's like, hey, man, you said that, you know, just the whole, like, adding the caveats. Like, I get it. I don't do it
every day. But when you hear people say, who are Trump fans, the voters elected, they are doing that to obscure the fact that he's not a popular vote winner. Now, so we've gotten a bit off track. I want to get back to the poll numbers. So the point is, he started off bad approval-wise in the mid-40s, which you can say, so what? He won in the mid-40s, so that's status quo for him. Spent a lot of 2017 in the mid-upper 30s. He passed the tax cut bill, and then he got back into the 40s. He's been at the 40s essentially throughout 2018. But just in the past 2 weeks, you're seeing several polls, NPR, Marist, CNN, Quinnipiac, and ABC Washington Post, that have him below 40. I think they're generally around 38. Now, there are a few other polls that Gallup's at 40. There are a handful of others that are low 40s. But the Real Clear Politics average is a full 3-point drop from 43 to 40 over the past 2 weeks. So, now 3 points is not, you know, an earthquake, but it is a significant, it's the biggest drop that we've seen, I think, in all of 2018 in the average. Well, and so it's, what might be accounting only, for that?
When you're only at 40% and you lose 3%, that's a significant percent of your percent. Look, if he's at 100% and he's down to 97, we're like, nothing right. to worry about. Right. But he doesn't have a lot of room for error.
Right.
You know, and
the bill running for the House have to be concerned that if they don't have a lot of support, a lot of wind at their back, how is that going to affect their races?
And this is not just an outlier. This is 3 or 4 polls. This is a trend now. Maybe he rebounds next week, but I think we have enough evidence to now say that something, it looks like something's going on.
What is that something? Of all the nonsense that's occurred over the past year and a half, what is it about these last 2 weeks that has caused this shift? Where essentially there are a handful of soft Trump voters who have toggled to some degree the past year and a half that have tipped over against Trump past 2 weeks.
The only thing that makes sense is just that there's an exhaustion, that it's the accumulation of stuff, and that we're finally at some point it gets old and the exhaustion takes a toll, right? I mean, because I don't think you can't compare anything that's happened in the past week to Charlottesville, to Helsinki, to Comey. There have been so many other big moments that should have been much more damaging than anything that's happened in the past couple of weeks.
Now, I saw one theory floated on Twitter, and forgive me if I get the person's name wrong. I think it's Noah Rothman from Commentary, but if I'm mistaken, I apologize.
Friend of the show.
Yeah.
Friend of the pod.
It was suggested that the tipping point here was the passing of McCain. That there was
that's
such that there was such this national reverence towards his brand of bipartisanship, which of course many on the left thinks think is phony, but it certainly was aired in a constant loop in the media for several days. It was reflected in all the memorial services. It was mentioned repeatedly that Trump was actively snubbed from even attending the service, and Trump responded by playing golf when everyone in Washington was gathered at the National Cathedral. Could that have? I mean, that's happening just before all the revelations in the Woodward book and the anonymous op-ed, so it's hard to, you know, separate out all these different factors.
Sure.
But that was one theory that I saw proffered.
Well, who's to say, but I give him kudos for a hot take, and I mean that not, I don't mean that derisively, I mean that in an admiring way. That's an interesting argument. Who knows, but wow, I went on CNN the day, you know, I guess the day of or the day after the funeral, and said, like, this is great, but it won't matter tomorrow. Like, nobody's going to become, change their opinion based on these, you know, amazing speeches. As much reverence as I have for McCain, Trump will tweet something tomorrow, and that'll be what everybody obsesses about. And a week from now, it'll feel like the McCain funeral was 6 months ago. But who's to say?
Well, I mean, if it is a factor here, I mean, it's notable because, you know, McCain does not have, I mean, even now in death, there's still plenty of conservatives that truly dislike McCain, thought him as not as a political traitor. There even some thought he was an actual traitor from the POW camp. But that's far the fringe.
You know what I just learned about, by the way, Bill? You'll dig this as a history guy. So Russ Roberts, who has this awesome economics podcast called Econ Talk, but he also delves into a lot of history. And he just had a guy on who's like a Russia expert, and they were talking about Solzhenitsyn. How do I pronounce that?
I do not know, but I know what you're talking
about. Okay. And it came up in the conversation that when Russian POWs were liberated from Nazi concentration or from not concentration from prison camps. So these are Russians who were captured by the Nazis. They get released and they come back to Russia. Russia, the Soviet Union, would either execute them or put them in the gulag based on the fact that they were probably compromised or turned by the Nazis. Isn't that just horrific? But yeah. I think there's a similar, you know, amongst a certain fringe element on the right, and I would have to assume this is a very small fringe element, on the American right, there does seem to be a similar notion about McCain, that he somehow, you know, rather than celebrating him as a hero, that somehow that experience turned him into a Manchurian candidate.
Right. And there are people that attributed his opposition to torture as connected to that in a negative way, that he's not being hardcore against terrorism. He doesn't want to waterboard the way Dick Cheney and Donald Trump do, because he was warped by this experience. So I remember Trump's first big break with norms was saying to a conservative audience, you know, that John McCain wasn't a hero because he was captured. He likes people that weren't captured. And people thought he was...
Remember, Trump had been a birther before, but you're saying as a candidate.
As a candidate. So, yeah. I mean, that was the first moment when traditional political pundits said, okay, this is a total joke. He's going to go into the trash bin now. When in fact...
Also when Bill Kristol turned on him.
Right.
People forget. Bill Kristol had been a sort of booster of legitimizing Trump's campaign early on, but that was a bridge too far.
But to many people who were anti-McCain on the right, that was a sign of Trump's authenticity and willingness to not be politically correct. So if it is true that McCain's death is hurting Trump, I mean, that I don't think it means that the anti-McCain, pro-Trump right doesn't exist. I think that's still essentially the core of his base. But that there is that soft Trump vote that has always been iffy about him, the people that disapproved of him upon election day but still voted for him. Mm-hmm. And maybe some of those folks were hoping that he would be, you know, post-partisan and would find a way to make Washington work in a way that the Democratic establishment wasn't able to do. And this was a stark reminder that Trump has not lived up to that potential.
So, now, again, Noah may – I haven't read Noah's piece, and he may have some data points or some
It was just a tweet. I don't think he wrote a whole article.
Okay. All right. But, okay, so and maybe he's looking at a timeline that I'm not aware of, but isn't it more plausible that the Woodward book would have been responsible for this? If we're going to assign an event to this rather than just the accumulation of stuff – isn't it more likely that the Bob Woodward book would have done this than the McCain funeral?
Well, I think there was a little bit of softness because the ABC Washington Post poll was, I think, taken in late August.
Okay.
I think before the anonymous op-ed and the Woodward book stuff, but I would want to double check that. And so at the time, people were like, well, maybe this is an outlier poll. But now we've seen several polls since that are more seemingly in closer proximity to the Woodward book and the anonymous op-ed. So again, it's hard to separate it all.
Gotcha.
But it is, they do come together in that this is evidence that this is a White House that is dysfunctional. We all sort of knew, but it's being, when it comes from Michael Wolff and Omarosa, it has a different sheen than if it would come from literally somebody inside the White House and Bob Woodward, who for whatever, you know, he certainly has his critics, but is seen as a more credible figure than Wolf and Omarosa. And all these narratives are in sync. They all say roughly the same thing, that may give it a different level of import than what we've had in the past.
Gotcha. You know, I think this is a potentially big story. Now, if the poll numbers bounce back, then obviously it's not. But if this is the new normal, even though you've only lost 2 or 3 points, he doesn't have a lot of points to lose. And, you know, and so I think this could be, you know, if you know, and sometimes these populists, they just wear people out over time, and their shtick gets old. And, you know, in the case of McCarthy, I think it took years, but at some point people would just get sick of the shtick. And like, we may look back and say, okay, well, this is one of the moments where it started to come to show up. Then again, maybe not. The guy's resilient. You got to give him that.
Now, I've heard from folks who are trying to, you know, keep spirits up on the Republican side. Well, we're going to get Kavanaugh soon. You know, he's going to get another big win just in a week or so. Kavanaugh's going to get confirmed.
I'm tired of winning.
Now, I think that, you know, Kavanaugh's confirmation could well be followed by a government shutdown, which might blunt any sort of momentum. But when we were pre-gaming, you told me something that I was not expecting you to say, which is you don't think Kavanaugh did a very good job.
Not really. Not really. No, I mean, I agree with you. I don't think he did a very good job. Now, the caveats are, as I wrote at the Daily Beast, I think Democrats threw a lot of, histrionics and in some cases, bogus info at him. And I think he'll be confirmed. And I would vote if I were in the U.S. Senate. I would vote to confirm him. So, like, let's just start with that. But he really didn't do a very good job. He was basically played defense the whole time. Now, I don't think a lot of points were scored against him. He blocked a lot of goals, but go back and watch. I would just challenge this. Watch the highlight reel of Gorsuch's confirmation and then watch Kavanaugh's. Gorsuch was dramatically smoother, dramatically more likable, and much more on offense. Just intellectually, philosophically. Kavanaugh, I don't think Kavanaugh had the personality of Gorsuch. I also think Kavanaugh, and maybe it's by virtue of the fact that, you know, Gorsuch was simply replacing Scalia, and Kavanaugh has the potential to really shift the court in a rightward direction. But I do not think the hearings went as well. I think some of it may be the paper trail that Mitch McConnell warned about, you know, back in the New York Times a couple months ago, that he had a lot more stuff to defend, not just being on the bench for a decade or more. No,
it's the emails and the memos from when he was in the White House, when he was part of the Whitewater investigation. I mean, this is the biggest paper trail for a Supreme Court nominee we've had in a very, very long time.
And so my point, and I'm writing a column for The Beast about this, hopefully, I mean, you never know, because I'm supposed to publish it on Friday, and, you know, sometimes there could be intervening events that would make, you know, render this sort of a back burner story. But I think that if I'm advising conservatives, you know, Republicans, Trump, the Federalist Society, I think there's a tendency that if you win, you did everything right, and if you lose, you did everything wrong. And I think it's likely Republicans are going to win this nomination. They should not gloss over the lessons learned here.
What are the lessons learned?
I think, and I'm still fleshing this out, I'd love to get your input, but I think one thing is just a personality thing. I think that, you know, for whatever reason, Gorsuch was more likable. And I think Gorsuch was much smoother. Now, maybe I'd like to know, were they prepared differently? Or is it just a personality thing? I don't know. But maybe if they did some sort of preparation for Gorsuch that they didn't do for Kavanaugh, that would be interesting to know. Also, I think you have to ask your questions about the paper trail. Now, as you know, I wanted Amy Coney Barrett, who would have had the opposite problem, a lack of experience on the bench, although she had been a Supreme Court law clerk as well as a professor, a law professor. I have to go back and look about Gorsuch, his paper trail, not as extensive as Kavanaugh's, to be sure.
Well, I mean, but to your point about likability and presence, I mean, they went in overdrive, Trump and his team, to sell Kavanaugh as, you know, your friendly next door neighbor. He coaches basketball.
Right. Maybe they needed to, though.
Well, yeah. I mean, I assume you always need to some degree. I mean, we're at a point now with these nomination processes that there needs to be some sort of biographical narrative that essentially obscures what they're actually going to do on the bench. It really doesn't matter how nice a guy you are. It depends on how you rule on cases. But they had a whole bunch of op-eds. Like, I'm a liberal, but he drives my kids in the carpool, and he's great. You know.
Yeah. I think that helped. But look, I mean, I don't want to compare, you know, the different types of hearings. But Oliver North's hearing, and he had a much tougher
job. Different kind of hearing.
He had a much tougher job, but Oliver North came out looking pretty good. In terms of the likability,
but that was a more combative type of hearing where someone's being accused of a crime, they're trying to defend themselves.
Yeah, it's a different type of hearing, but I think they basically called Kavanaugh a liar and accused him of committing perjury and accused him of, you know, I mean, this was a combative hearing as well. Look at Cory Booker and Kamala Harris.
But you're not trying to say I'm not guilty. You're trying to say I deserve a lifetime pardon on the Supreme Court. So
no, it's a different.
If you're slashing back. I mean, that was that was sort of the Bork problem, that he was a little he was sort of gleefully combative in talking about the issues at stake and was a little too transparently ideological, and that hurt him. You know, there was no lovable backstory to Robert Bork to smooth out the rough edges.
Yeah, no, I mean, and Bork didn't care to turn on the charm.
Right.
If he had the, I don't know if he had the ability to, but he didn't want, maybe he thought it was beneath him to, but it just, I would challenge anybody, go back and watch the highlight reel of Gorsuch. I mean, he's smiling. He is personable. He is, thank you very much for that question. He's got energy, for one thing. Kavanaugh, I felt like Kavanaugh was actually on trial.
Well, I mean, the difference is, and this was McConnell's warning, there's a lot of documents here that go beyond judicial philosophy, that go below him as a person, his political views, his partisanship. I mean, no one's had to deal with those sorts of questions in a Supreme Court hearing, and I can't remember when that's ever happened before. I mean, this was a way for, I mean, we talked about this in the past. I mean, the reason why Harry Myers went down was that folks on the right were sick and tired of having to put up nominees who were empty suits. I mean, John Roberts was considered a very credible pick, but he had a very minimal time on the bench. I guess he did have memos from his time in the Reagan White House, but that was a long, he was Reagan, not Bush, right? He was in the administration.
Roberts?
Yeah.
I don't know. I would think Bush, but I could be wrong.
Forgive me if I'm getting something wrong here. I don't remember there being a lot of smoke and gun type memos. Maybe there was something at abortion in there. But it was sort of like Kavanaugh's something, but it wasn't really like his personal opinion.
Yeah, I think Roberts had been like very careful not to leave a lot of breadcrumbs.
Right, right. So very few rulings. So with Myers, there was this pushback saying it is time to nominate a plain conservative, someone who has been a conservative, who has ruled like a conservative, who defends conservatism, who defends strict constructionist originalism on the court, and not be ashamed about it.
I disagree with the way that you frame that or the narrative.
Okay.
So I would say that Roberts is much more in keeping with Alito and Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, and that Myers is the outlier there. Danger was that Myers was going to be like a David Souter.
But there's some other way that said that about Roberts too, because he hadn't proved himself on the court yet. He hadn't had enough time on the bench for you to know exactly what he's going to do, and there he goes and upholds Obamacare. So, I mean, there wasn't obviously a huge conservative pushback to Roberts because he was, I think, a known commodity within Washington circles. But there was a bit of pushback at the time saying, you know, why can't we have somebody who is has the paper trail, who's proven their conservatism? And then I agree with you that Myers was less proven within Washington conservative circles than Roberts. And that's part of the reason why the backlash was stronger, but it also was a desire on their part to ratchet things up. Okay, we got Roberts. Now let's take the next step.
Okay, I definitely agree with you that there was a fear that Harriet Myers was unproven. She was a nepotism pick. And there was a fear that she would become like a David Souter. But I think the reason is that Roberts and Alito and Kavanaugh and Gorsuch are all intellectuals who are sort of Federalist Society approved.
No, I agree with that.
Vetted people. And so it wasn't the fact that they had a lot of rulings specifically or a lot of paper trail. It was that they had been identified, you know, recruited, trained, like vetted. They had been part of this network, this infrastructure that had been created specifically to deal with the fact that Republican nominees were either being borked or were being confirmed and then would flip.
Well, Roberts was the sweet spot. I mean, Roberts was someone who was known in those Federalist Society circles without the long judicial paper trail.
Yes.
And then there were some conservatives that said, that's not good enough for me. I want more than just your say-so. I want to see it in writing. And so someone like Kavanaugh is someone who is even deeper in the Republican Party apparatus, having part of Ken Starr's team, being part of the Bush administration, and right. having a considerable time on the bench. And this is a way to, and so even McConnell was saying, look, there's a lot of documents here. You got to sift through. It's going to be a bit of, not saying we can't do it,
but. Happy lift, guys. I don't want to relitigate this. And I don't want to go through it again because it's boring and sour grapes. But as I noted earlier, I laid out the case for Amy Coney Barrett. And I think I would actually trust her more that she is going to stay solidly conservative based on cultural reasons. And she doesn't have that extensive paper trail.
But is there anything in the Kavanaugh hearings you don't like the presentation that he gave?
Yeah.
But as far as his articulation of his judicial philosophy, was there anything in there that should concern you as a conservative?
No. I mean, look, the reasons that liberals are against him for a whole bunch of other reasons, right? There's some people are saying he committed perjury. Some people are saying, you know, Kamala Harris apparently edited a response of him talking about Roe versus Wade in a way that
abortion-inducing drugs. And the question was he saying, this is my view of these drugs, that I consider them abortion-inducing, or am I speaking from the perspective of these litigants who felt that way?
He said, like, they believe or they think such and such, and she just cut out the they believe part.
Right. Although she then put up a second video, which was fuller context. I mean, she's still arguing that, even with that, he is still using the terminology as if it is the proper terminology.
But Elias halfway across the world before the truth gets its pants on. But anyway, so my point though is, you know, I'm not criticizing him based on his, you know, judicial philosophy or any like egregious errors that he made. I'm just saying, I think I'm the only person, I think, on the right or on the center right, basically saying, let's just take a second and like, he's going to, you know, again, he's probably going to be confirmed and that's great, but let's just take a second and admit or cop to the fact that like, this was not a great confirmation hearing.
Your takeaway is that there were more compelling, exciting, conservative choices like Amy Barrett.
That's half of it. The other half was, I think he was playing defense the whole time. Right. And that may have something to do with his communication skills. It may have something to do with the preparation, or it may have to do with the fact that he had this hundreds of thousands of documents.
So you're also saying you want to go back to smaller paper trails.
Let's think
For smoother confirmation.
We need to have a conversation about it. Look, if you're a football team and you win the game, but you could have lost and you barely won, you should watch the game film and say, we need to fix this next week instead of, well, we won, so we're perfect.
See, I would have a different takeaway. I think this is going to prove that no matter how messy your paper trail is, no matter the possibility that you did commit perjury on the stand, dress up a good backstory, keep your team in line, it doesn't matter. You don't have to narrow your field to the squeakiest, cleanest, most charismatic choices. You can take the ugly candidate with all the breadcrumbs, and you can still push that guy through. At the end of the day,
you can do that.
If your base is on board, the person's going to be a down the line conservative. They're not going to care.
Well, you can do that as long as you get rid of the filibuster, and and as long as you have Susan Collins. But one change, one thing. I mean, yes. In this current environment, Republicans were able, probably able to push through Kavanaugh. I think it would be a mistake to assume that that you could replicate that in a slightly different environment.
Well, certainly if Democrats had control of the Senate, which they might,
I don't think so.
You're not gonna get a Kavanaugh through. I think it'd even be hard to even get a Manchin and a Heitkamp to play ball with a pick like this. You're gonna have to swerve to the center to get those folks on board.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing is think about all the stars that have had to have aligned for this to happen, including the fact that like you're probably gonna pick up Manchin, you know. Because he happens to be on the ballot this year.
Right. So long as you keep Collins and Murkowski on board, which I think you probably will.
Right.
I think Collins is in big trouble here, or potentially in big trouble, because she has really stuck her neck out to say, don't worry, Roe v. Wade is fine. He's going to respect precedent. Gorsuch is going to respect precedent. Roberts is going to respect precedent. It's all good here. You know, if she's wrong... I mean, a lot of times you take these votes and people forget about them, but I think she is so, her neck is so far out here.
Yes. Well, let's talk about that. I find it interesting. Now, look, I'm glad that she's doing this because I think Kavanaugh is qualified. I think he's got the experience. That may be a problem for the confirmation, but he's experienced. He's got the qualifications. She's a Republican. I mean, look, I'm glad she's doing this, but I think you're right to say that it's a risky move. And I'm curious why she's making this calculation. I mean, there's risks either way. If she were to turn against her party at this moment, when they have nominated a qualified, serious, experienced judge, that would carry risks as well. Why do you believe that she has? Is this a vote on principle for her, or is this just a calculation that this is less risky than the other move? Why is she doing this?
I mean, I have no idea what makes Susan Collins actually tick, like what her actual belief system is, so I'm not going to speculate on that. As far as politics are concerned, look, Maine has largely been a blue state with a big independent streak. They've had independent governors, they've had an independent senator in Angus King, they've had third party independents who are centrists who get large chunks of the vote when they run. And they have a history of, you know, Republican moderates, liberal Republicans, pro-choice Republicans, of Collins being one of them. But there's also the rise of the LePage right. So she's really squeezed between the hard right and the center in Maine. But her base of support has been her pro-choice bona fides. She has run on that for her whole career. And she gets votes from Democrats because of that. So, you know, she might be at risk if she broke ranks in a Republican primary, but she'd also be poised to pull a Joe Lieberman or a Lisa Murkowski and run as an independent if she did get ousted in the Republican primary. But she made a choice to stay loyal to the Republican Party when it comes to judges. Although, I mean, she's voted for Democratic judges too, but she's never broken ranks for a Republican judge. And, I mean, I suggested in my political piece that she could have broken ranks and said, I'm going to partner with the red state Democrats and demand a centrist judge. Yeah. She obviously didn't do that.
I remember mocking that idea.
Yeah. But if she's going to be party line here, I don't think she had to say, trust me, he told me he's going to respect precedent, and I think Roe is safe. Because now she's not in control what happens next. She could have drawn a different line for herself, which is, I can't have any kind of issues litmus as it comes for a judge. I only can take his or her qualifications, and that's it. Don't blame me. We shouldn't say that bluntly. Don't blame me what happens next. That's not my job here as a senator.
That would have been a smarter move.
So she is now dependent on what these guys do once they get there. And, I mean, I don't know if they're going to, you know, decimate Roe in a two-year window. She's up for re-election in 2020. Maybe it's not going to be that dramatic. Maybe there's a case that comes up and they whittle away at Roe and don't flat overturn Roe. But she's not in control of her destiny here. And if they do something dramatic on Roe, I think she's going to pay for it.
No, I think you're right. It would have been – she could have framed this better. The good news for her is I don't – if Roe is ever overturned, I don't think it's going to happen quickly. But she's in an interesting position. And going back, you know, I don't want to harp on this anymore, but just to put a pin on it, part of my argument is that, you know, yeah, Kavanaugh is going to get confirmed, but like, there's no guarantee. Like, the fact that the senator from Maine has made this calculation was not and is not a foregone conclusion. It was not, and we cannot count on that. And so I think you've got to learn the lessons even from victory. And there's a tendency to think that you did everything right when you win. And I think that would be a mistake for those of us who care about the courts.
One last talk before we wrap things up for the day. It is Wednesday we're taping. It's always dangerous to tape midweek.
A little early for us.
But tomorrow, when tonight is the Rhode Island primary, where you have a left versus establishment primary. The incumbent governor, Raimondo, is not loved by the left. She is more of a pro-business Democrat. She tried to cut pensions, public pensions, as governor to save money. And so Matt Brown is challenging her from the left. So we'll see if this is one last chance, which is not quite one last chance, the penultimate chance for the left to make their mark in the primary season. It would be the first time there was a statewide win for a leftist challenger if it happens. And there's not a lot of polling there, so we don't quite know where things stand. And then Thursday, you have the Andrew Cuomo, Cynthia Nixon primary, where polling shows Cuomo ahead by a huge amount, 40 points last I saw. But he's had a rough final stretch where there was a mailer from the state Democratic Party that accused Cynthia Nixon of being for the Israeli boycott, which she denies. There's a story in the Times that the unveiling of the new Mario Cuomo Bridge, replacing the former Tappan Zee, was accelerated to happen just before the primary. Cuomo initially denied that. There's a document that shows someone in the government leaning on a contractor to speed things up, although that person said this wasn't untoward incentive. This is just a normal back and forth.
Bill, if we've learned anything from politics, it's that no politicizing bridges could make any difference to anybody.
At least it's building a bridge and not wrecking a bridge. So I don't know if I doubt that's going to allow Nixon to jump up 40 points and win the primary. But there's also the lieutenant governor's race where there is a Cynthia Nixon ally running as a challenger to the incumbent. And you have the attorney general's race, which you have two folks on the left, Zephyr Teachout and James. What's it, Letitia James? I'm forgetting the first name wrong. There's also a more moderate candidate in Sean Patrick Maloney. So maybe the left splits between James and Teachout and Maloney wins. So we don't know what's going to happen there. So there's a few things happening that we need to keep an eye out for.
Let me ask you, I feel like New York's overrated. I feel like New York gets more attention than they deserve.
Home to presidents.
As someone who's ostensibly, you know, like a part of the cosmopolitan establishment or something, I'm very anti-New York, and I blame them for Donald Trump in many ways.
Well, didn't you tweet out the article from Ben Adler talking about how the New York mentality has taken over the Republican Party and the conservative movement, that you need to prove your New York brashness. You need to be a Christie or a Giuliani or a Scaramucci to make it in today's Republican Party.
Yeah, and actually, this is a good segue for me to plug. I taped a podcast yesterday with a guy, Chris Noviembro. I don't know if you know him.
I don't.
And he has a podcast called the All in the Family podcast. Did you watch that show?
Well, Bill? I mean, I didn't watch it back to back, but I watched it like anyone else at that time. And I've gone back and watched some of the earlier episodes when it was more political, and they're amazing.
They're really good, right?
Yeah. They're really good TV in and of itself, and they're politically fascinating because Bunker is so much a vessel of today's modern right.
It's actually more relevant to watch today than it would have been 20 years ago. You know, it's a show from 40 years ago, but it's more relevant today. Anyway, Chris Noviembro has this podcast that I'm actually supporting on Patreon. I recommend it. And it's called the All in the Family podcast. And he and his co-host, who is like an expert on media, you know, has degrees in media or something like, you know, film or whatever, they're going through and every podcast episode is an episode of All in the Family. Mm-hmm. So they're going through every season, every episode, and doing a show where they talk about the story arc and they talk about, like, for, I'll give you one example, like the character Lionel.
Yeah.
Which is George Jefferson's son.
Right.
Is an early on super interesting character.
Oh, and he's interesting from the get go. I mean, the first season, the interaction between Lionel and Archie Bunker are just fantastic.
And Meathead, too.
Yeah. But the thing is, Meathead is, I think people underappreciate that Meathead is kind of a meathead. I mean, he is articulating a very crude version of liberalism.
Yeah.
I mean, he has more moral high ground than Archie does, but there is a weakness to it as well that Archie sometimes picks apart.
Meathead is also, when you juxtapose him with Lionel, and this is something, by the way, that never occurred to me when I was a kid watching the reruns, but of course, now going back and listening to this podcast, when you juxtapose Meathead to Lionel, you can really see...
Yeah, Lionel's the much sharper character.
Yes. And Meathead is much... And Mike, we'll call him Mike. Mike is much more privileged. You know, he has the privilege of, like, taking college classes and getting to, like, participate in student government or whatever, play politics, whereas Lionel's out there hustling, working for the law, you know, for his dry cleaning family business.
Right. And eventually Mike, you know, skips out of town and goes and joins a commune. So he shows his cards at the end of the day. But at the start of that Ben Adler piece you tweeted out, they mentioned, I didn't know this, that Norman Lear, who started the show, was obviously trying to skewer conservatism with Archie Bunker. But in fact, conservatives identify with Archie Bunker, even though he was saying outlandish things. And he became the most lovable character on the show.
In fairness, I think Norman Lear created a very complex character, and there are parts of Archie. People, I know it's my birthday, and I appreciate the call.
I did not know it was your birthday. Happy birthday.
But you call me once, I put you in voicemail. I did that on – I'm taping. I love you.
Celebrate your birthday with me. I feel very honored here.
Mom, you don't call back again when I'm working. Where was I?
Archie Bunker.
I think Norman Lear created a very complicated character that does have a very likable and sentimental side. And when I was interviewing Chris Noviembro about the All in the Family podcast yesterday, I mentioned the possibility that he should write a column about Donald Trump being Archie Bunker, and he says, well, the comparison is not fair to Archie.
Well, and I think that, and I'm sure he would know this better than me, my sense is that as the public began to like Archie Bunker, the writers began to soften the character, and in the later years, the show got less and less political, and Archie became more and more cuddly. Yeah.
By the way, I said it wrong. It's Chris Novembrino.
Okay.
And he's on Twitter, and it's called the All in the Family podcast. This is how shows get ruined. You remember the first season of Happy Days? Fonzie is a thug. He's a hood. He is a. It's a little bit edgy.
Yeah.
And then eventually, a couple seasons in, Fonzie's like substitute teaching kids, foreign kids, and he's like a total. They wanted to change it to Fonzie's Happy Days, and they're like cartoons about Fonzie. You know what I mean? So, like, I haven't been through the entire catalog, but I'm willing to bet. And by the way, at the end, there's a show called Archie's Place,
right? Which is terrible.
Which is like a spinoff with Archie Bunker, like adopts like a girl,
right?
Like,
and Edith's not there anymore. It's unwatchable.
But I would be willing to bet that the first season is probably much better than the last.
The first season is incredible, and it's stuff that you'd be hard pressed to find on TV today because it's so raw, it's so combative. I mean, I think it's what Roseanne wanted to emulate with the new Roseanne show, and didn't quite get there. Controversy aside,
so this was all me bashing New York to get back to
Cuomo Nixon.
I'm critical of New York, and but I don't follow, like, you know, and I work for the Daily Beast, which is based in New York, and like a lot of, you know, the top people that work in New York. So like they know a lot about New York. All I can tell you is just from like flipping TV channels and stuff, I was under the assumption that Cynthia Nixon was running neck and neck with Cuomo. that this was a really close race. Apparently, you're saying a 40-point. I heard a lot about, for somebody who's probably going to lose in a landslide, I heard an awful lot about this race.
Well, look, this happened with Bernie Hillary in New York State. This happened with Cuomo Zephyr Teachout in New York State. I mean, there is a faction of the left based in New York City that is hardcore socialist. There's socialist radio stations in New York City that have been around for a long time. My friends at Chapo Trap House are based in Brooklyn, Democratic Socialists of America chapter. And they're part of the, you know, media capital of the world. And so they get a lot of attention. And we forget that not just is there upstate New York, which is not nearly as far to the left as the city. The city is not as far to the left as Brooklyn, Manhattan. There's Staten Island, which is very Republican. Outer Queens, outer Brooklyn. There is not a lot of, I mean, where Nixon is polling is very similar to where Teachout was polling when she ran statewide against Cuomo. There's no evidence that this has been a growing faction of the state. I mean, even Ocasio-Cortez, you know, she won in that part of the city.
Let's talk about someone who's punching above her weight in terms of media exposure.
Where she's from, she did take out, you know, a high-ranking Democrat, but it's in a part of the country which is one of the leftmost parts of the country and is not reflective not only of the country but of New York State. So you know, Cuomo.
But they happen to have a lot of TV cameras there, right, as well. I mean, this is the media capital of the world,
right? So now look, so I think Cuomo's going to win. Of course, the question is he going to win in a way that elevates his stature nationwide, where he stood up to the socialist left and came out in flank. I brought minimum wage. I expanded affordable college. I expanded equal gay rights. I've done this stuff. Who cares if I do it in a brass knuckles New York way? Who cares about these ethical gray areas? I get the job done. The New York Times editorial essentially endorsed him, saying we're really uncomfortable with all these ethical problems, but he has got a lot of stuff done. So is he going to look good at the end of the day, or is he so picked apart, and so his name is so sullied amongst the left that there's no way he could have national ambition anymore?
Well, the only thing I can endorse here is Sex and the City, which I've seen every episode of, and literally went to the theaters to see Sex and the City 2.
Such a metrosexual, Matt.
I went with my smoking hot wife, but yes, I did go. And I think I'm a Carrie. You are a Samantha, clearly.
Is that right?
But there's some, apparently, you know, it's just like people say Entourage wouldn't work today. But there's some second guessing on some of the.
Sarah Jessica Parker said herself that it wouldn't work today. It wasn't a true reflection of all of New York. It wasn't diverse enough. It was too elitist and all that.
And I utterly reject that take because this show, I will stand by the show. Anyway, that is where I guess this is the low point that we've arrived at. We went from All in the Family to Sex in the City in like 3 minutes.
So what are you going to plug before we sign off?
Well, I've already plugged my latest podcast, but I do want to plug my next podcast. I'm interviewing Chris Steerwalt, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Steerwalt. You may remember him from Fox News. Do you remember in 2012 when Karl Rove was saying, I don't believe that Obama won Ohio.
Right.
We shouldn't be calling the election.
Right.
And then the camera... Megyn Kelly gets up from behind the desk and the camera follows her down the hallway to the Fox News election, you know, the nerve center.
Right.
And Chris Steerwalt was among the people who were like, no, There are not enough Romney votes left in Ohio. I that's what I really gained a lot of respect for him. And he has a new book out, which I want to highly recommend. It's called Every Man a King, and it's very concise. And there's like a chapter on Wallace. There's a chapter on Bryan. There's a chapter on Buchanan. It's just each chapter is about a different populist figure in American history. It's written very like colloquially, very. I mean, Steirwald, I believe, is from West Virginia. It's funny. It's an easy read, and he is coming on my podcast, Lord willing, tomorrow to discuss it. So check that out on iTunes.
All right, I got nothing to plug, so let's call it a day.
You make me feel bad by saying that. You make me look like I don't know. Panderer or a shameless.
I'm the one looking better. I have nothing to plug.
We see things differently. I see you as a very humble man. You killed it so much the last couple of weeks, Bill, with your pieces in Politico magazine that were just blowing up. I think you deserve a couple days off.
Well, thank you very much.
Yes.
Till next week, sir.
All right. See you guys.
Bye.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.